From Pacifica Network, this is Democracy Now.
Que mi responsabilidad es decir hasta aquí puedo llegar.
I have made the decision to present my resignation from the office of President of the Republic.
Mi renuncia al cargo de Presidente de la República.
Bolivian President Carlos Mesa has offered to resign amid mass street protests calling for the nationalization of the country's natural gas resources. We'll go to Bolivia to get the latest. Then the U.S. Supreme Court rules the federal government can prosecute the sick for the medical use of marijuana, even in states where it's legal.
We're ill. We're not trying to be disobedient. We're just using this medicine because it's what's saving our lives.
And in a Democracy Now! Exclusive, we'll speak with Iraq war resister Ryan Johnson. He just crossed the border into Canada to seek refugee status. We'll talk about how he fled to Vancouver with his wife and his reasons for saying no to war.
I would love to be able to just show people, you know, that it's not worth it and that this war is illegal.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Bolivian President Carlos Mesa has offered to resign after mass street protests forced him to flee his office. On Monday, indigenous groups led a mass protest of some 80,000 Bolivians to call for the nationalization of the country's gas reserves. The protests overwhelmed the city police, and the president had to flee his office after demonstrators threatened to storm the presidential palace. We will go to Bolivia to get a report. In Iraq, at least 18 people have died, 48 have been wounded, after a series of car bomb attacks in the northern city of Huij. The near-simultaneous blast targeted checkpoints in the Sunni city. Most of those killed were Iraqi soldiers. Meanwhile, in Baghdad, a car bombing has injured at least 28 people. More than 825 have now died since the new Iraqi government formed in late April. Meanwhile, the Shiite cleric Muqtada al-Sadr has condemned the new Iraqi government, has vowed to stay from politics until after U.S. troops leave Iraq. In a rare interview, al-Sadr told the Associated Press, quote, "As long as the occupier is here, I will not interfere in the political process. I would like to condemn and denounce the last Iraqi government's decision to legalize the occupation." He went on to say, quote, "In reality, the electoral process was designed to legitimize the occupation rather than ridding the country of the occupation." Al-Sadr also indirectly criticized Iraq's top Shiite cleric, Grand Ayatollah Ali al-Sistani, for promoting the process that led to the formation of the country's Shiite-led government. The medical marijuana movement has been dealt a setback. The U.S. Supreme Court has ruled the federal government can prosecute patients who use marijuana even if they live in states that have legalized marijuana for medical purposes. California and nine other states have passed laws that protect patients from state prosecution if they obtain marijuana with a recommendation from a doctor. The Supreme Court decision, however, does not overturn the state laws. The lead plaintiff in the case, Angel Raich of Oakland, vowed to keep taking marijuana to combat her pain and illness.
I have a wasting syndrome, and I just can't simply hold on to my weight. And cannabis makes me hungry. Without it, I can't even swallow the food.
We'll have more on the ruling later in the program. The International Criminal Court in The Hague has launched a war crimes probe into the mass killings in the Darfur region of the Sudan. Over the past 2 years, at least 180,000 people have died in the region. Over 2 million people have been left homeless. Although the Sudanese government has been implicated in the killings, the Bush administration has secretly resumed ties to the government. The Los Angeles Times recently reported the CIA has been holding secret meetings with Sudanese intelligence chief Major General Salah Abdallah Ghosh, even though he has been accused by members of Congress of directing military attacks against civilians in Darfur. The Associated Press is reporting the Israeli army has begun using a new weapon in the occupied territories that aimed to disperse crowds by emitting painful bursts of sound at special frequencies. The sound machine was reportedly first used on Friday during a protest by Palestinians against the construction of a 425-mile wall through the West Bank. Back in this country, a whistleblower at the Los Alamos Nuclear Labs has been severely assaulted just weeks before he was scheduled to testify before Congress about fraud at the nuclear lab. The whistleblower, Tommy Hooks, remains hospitalized with a fractured jaw and herniated disc. His attackers threatened him to keep silent. Hooks' wife quoted the assailants as saying, quote, "If you know what's good for you, you'll keep your mouth shut." The assault occurred in the parking lot of a bar in Santa Fe. An anonymous caller had asked Hooks to meet him there to discuss fraud at the labs. Hook went public earlier this year by appearing in CBS News. At the time, he said he'd found a disturbing pattern of financial irregularities in the lab's procurement division. And in New York, plans have fallen apart to build a largely publicly subsidized sports stadium on the west side of Manhattan. A state board failed to agree Monday on a financing plan for the stadium. Mayor Mike Bloomberg's proposal would have required as much as $1 billion in public subsidies. Bloomberg has pushed for the stadium to house the New York Jets football team and as a possible Olympic stadium. At $2.2 billion, the stadium would have been the most expensive stadium in the world. The Bolivian group Murmullata here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The indigenous-led rebellion in Latin America's poorest country, Bolivia, has taken a dramatic turn after weeks of massive protests that have crippled large sections of the country. President Carlos Mesa appeared on national television, told the country he's stepping down. As he spoke, tens of thousands of protesters remained in the streets of the capital, La Paz. This is Bolivian President Carlos Mesa.
Que mi responsabilidad es decir hasta aquí puedo llegar.
I have made the decision to present my resignation from the office of President of the Republic.
Presentar mi renuncia al cargo de Presidente de la República. Una renuncia que tiene un solo objetivo.
This is a resignation that has only one objective. The objective that Bolivian society keeps in mind that the sacrifice has to be genuine and it cannot be any other thing. And that I cannot do anything else but to hand over this responsibility so that a solution can be reached that gets us out of this situation which is putting the country and its future at serious risk.
En serio riesgo al país y a su futuro.
Bolivian President Carlos Mesa speaking last night on national television. This isn't the first time Mesa has offered to resign. In early May, as the protests against his government intensified, he submitted his resignation to the Congress, but it was refused in what many saw as a public show. This time, analysts say it's not the case. Earlier in the day, Mesa had to be evacuated from the presidential compound after the crowds in the streets swelled so large there was a real threat the demonstrators could storm the building. A few hours later, Mesa returned to the building under heavy military escort and prepared to deliver his address to the country. While much of the news reporting on Bolivia has interpreted the massive demonstrations as protests calling for the nationalization of the country's energy resources, that's just one part of the much bigger picture. The country is more than two-thirds indigenous. These communities are calling for what they call a nationalization of the government, a total overhaul of Bolivia's system, and true representation of the communities that constitute the majority of the country. We go now to Cochabamba, where we're joined on the line by longtime Bolivia activist Jim Schultz, runs an organization called the Democracy Center, writes a blog that can be found at democracyctr.org. He's also author of a new book called Deadly Consequences, the International Monetary Fund and Bolivia's Black February. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Jim Schultz.
Good morning, Amy.
Thanks it's good to have you on. With us. Can you talk about the latest?
Well, your listeners have it. Last night, the president, Carlos Mesa, announced his resignation. And this is not a charade. I don't think he's going to find the Congress rejecting his resignation this time around. What's going on is a very complicated political gaming. The demand from the people in the streets here is for two things. One is that the country retake control of its oil and gas resources, and second, that this constituent assembly be convened to rewrite the Constitution and to rewrite the political rules. It's clear to the power in this country that something's going to have to happen, and so there's been this effort over the weekend to placate the protests with something different, which would be new elections. Constitutionally, the way it works here is if the president resigns and the two leaders of the Congress both either resign or refuse to take over the presidency, it automatically triggers a caretaker presidency by the president of the Supreme Court and new elections. The Catholic Church has been trying to broker such a deal over the weekend, and Mesa was willing to be a part of that. It's unclear whether his resignation will trigger that scenario because the two congressional leaders have not made their intentions clear about what they're going to do. So we could end up being actually in a much worse situation in the next 24 hours because if his successor, the president of the Senate, Belenin Baca Diaz, if he were to actually assume the presidency, I think that this country will explode. He is a far, far less respected figure than even Carlos Mesa was.
What will happen right now, do you think? I wanted to turn for a minute to Evo Morales, who was also recorded speaking last night.
Si estamos planteando un decreto supremo para la recuperación de todos los hidrocarburos.
Evo Morales, of course, the socialist Congress member, many have talked about him being a future president. Among the demands Morales has laid out were for Carlos Mesa's presidency to be immediately ended. He also called on the leaders of the Bolivian Senate and House to waive their rights to succeed Mesa. Morales instead called on the president of Bolivia's Supreme Court to organize elections. He said it was the only way out of the crisis. Your response, Jim Schultz.
Well, I'm not sure I even agree with Evo on this. I'm not sure that the people who are in the streets are going to be happy with a call for new elections. Here's the situation. If they call new elections, they're talking about calling new elections under the existing system, under the existing rules. So you have, you know, hundreds of thousands of people in this country in the streets demanding that the rules of politics be rewritten. I'm not sure that saying, well, we're not going to rewrite the rules right now, we're going to elect a new government under the old rules, I'm not sure that really satisfies people. It doesn't address the issue of gas and oil, and it doesn't address the issue of holding a constituent assembly. And frankly, I think if we were to hold elections in August, September, October in this country, I think the most likely victor is going to be another former president, Tito Quiroga, who is a former IBM executive who doesn't even live here now. He lives primarily in the United States, and who, in his 1 year in office, killed more people than his predecessor, the former dictator, did in 4 years. So I think there's a trap here, and I don't know that just holding new elections, if new elections were held along with a commitment for the nationalization of oil and gas, and a commitment for a constituent assembly, then there might be some sort of package there. But new elections on its own, I don't see it settling this country down.
If this were to go according to the constitutional rules, it would go to the head of the Senate, would become the next president. But can you talk about what would happen if he were to take power?
Well, I mean, Evo Morales, he said a couple of weeks ago, he said if this guy takes office, he'll last 10 minutes. maybe 20. I think that, first of all, Ormando Batagués, who's the gentleman we're talking about, he is a politician allied with the former president, Gonzalo Sánchez de Lozada, who was kicked out of his country for killing his own people 2 years ago. He is from Santa Cruz, and those people who've been following the story understand that one of the things that's going on here in Bolivia is this regional split, where Santa Cruz, which is the wealthy area of the country where a lot of the oil and gas is located, is trying to demand autonomy and essentially get control of the oil and gas, or at least get a larger share of the oil and gas. So to put a Santa Cruz politician linked to a deposed president in the presidential palace at this moment in time is just about the stupidest thing that's happened.
Jim Schultz, finally, there's been some concern expressed that exploiting the vacuum in power, though the power definitely looks like it's in the hands of the people right now, that generals representing the far right wealthy in Santa Cruz could step into the void.
You know, I'm not as pessimistic about that as other people are. My sense is that, and the military, I think, has made this clear. Remember, this is a country that lived under dictatorship for many years. Any Bolivian over the age of 30 has lived under a dictatorship old enough to remember what it's like. And so the military, I think, is very hesitant to do that kind of thing. The only way in which I would see a military takeover, and this could change, would be if literally there was no government. If there was... there was no succession, no government. There just seemed to be no central authority whatsoever. I could imagine then the military stepping in. But there is a constitutional process in play here. It is being respected, and it needs to play out, and I think that will happen. And in the meantime, I think the pressures in the streets are going to continue, and I don't think that people are going to accept anything short at this point of nationalization, of the retaking of oil and gas into public hands.
Well, I want to thank you very much, Jim Schultz, for joining us. Jim Schultz speaking to us from Cochabamba, Bolivia. Again, the president of Bolivia, President Mesa, has offered his resignation as there is mass protest in the streets. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. As we turn now to the U.S. Supreme Court, it ruled Monday the federal government has the power to prosecute the use of marijuana for medical purposes, even in states where it's legal. In a 6-3 ruling, the court agreed with the Bush administration that the regulation of controlled substances, including marijuana, is the province of Congress without exception. Justice John Paul Stevens wrote for the majority, quote, "If there is any conflict between federal and state law, federal law shall prevail." The ruling does not strike down laws in 11 states that allow medicinal use of marijuana. The court was not asked to declare such statutes illegal. But the decision does mean those laws will not protect anyone from federal prosecution should a U.S. attorney or the Justice Department decide to bring charges. The latest ruling stems from a lawsuit brought in 2002 by two women, Diana Monson and Angel Raich, who have used marijuana to gain relief from excruciating pain under recommendation from their doctors. After DEA agents raided Monson's home, they sued the government to stop further raids. Monday's Supreme Court ruling reverses a decision of a San Francisco appeals court. Raich spoke to reporters yesterday, shortly after the decision was announced.
"That just because the Supreme Court today has ruled against me does not mean that the war on patients should begin. It means that it's time for the federal government to have some compassion and have some heart. And to please use common sense, do not waste taxpayers' dollars by coming in and locking us up. We're ill, we're not trying to be disobedient. We're just using this medicine because it's what's saving our lives."
Angel Raich, one of the two women, sued the government in 2002 over the medical use of marijuana. Shortly after the Supreme Court ruling yesterday, we talked with medical marijuana rights activist Ed Rosenthal, who joined us in our studio. We're going to go to break and then come back and talk to him about the significance of the U.S. Supreme Court ruling. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report, as we talk now about the U.S. Supreme Court decision, turning to marijuana rights activist Ed Rosenthal, a leading authority on cannabis, has served as an expert witness on marijuana cultivation in federal and state trials, arrested by federal agents in 2002. He has since been convicted on three marijuana cultivation felonies. I began by asking him about his own arrest.
I was growing starter plants so that patients could grow their own marijuana. And the federal government came and arrested me at 6 a.m. I ran downstairs. I thought a neighbor might need help. I was naked. Luckily, that way they couldn't shoot me. I had nothing hidden. They saw everything. And they were looking for, and then they went over to my nursery, which was in a 1,500 square foot building. It was about 400 square feet of cultivation. And this was a big Oakland warehouse that they were talking about. And what they found there was mother plants and cuttings so that were being rooted so that patients could use them. And then I went to trial, and the judge wouldn't let the jury hear that I was an officer of the city of Oakland or that I had been, that I was growing the plants for patients. And they arrested me. 2 hours after, they found me guilty.
So they convicted you?
They convicted me. 2 hours after I was found guilty, the jury started calling the news media, saying that they were duped, that they felt dirty, that they had been conned by the government because they hadn't been able to hear the whole story, which was that I was an officer of the city growing medical marijuana.
Explain what you mean when you say you were an officer of the city of Oakland.
The city created a position called an officer, a health officer of the city, to cultivate and specifically allowed us to cultivate marijuana. And the city's theory was that officers working for city and state governments are protected from the drug laws. For instance, a narcotics officer who carries or sells marijuana, if there wasn't something to protect him, he could be arrested. So that was under that same idea, they thought I was protected. And the city government told me that I was protected. I was sworn in. I was congratulated for being sworn in by city people. And then when it came time to the trial, the judge would not let the jury hear that.
And yet when you were sentenced, he did.
Yes. There was so much public pressure, and it was so much of an issue in the area that I think that the judge felt that it was better for the federal government to concede a little. So he didn't want the damage that would have been done to the drug laws if I had been jailed. And what the judge did was he sentenced me to 1 day in prison time served.
And you had served already. But yeah. Now your case...
They owe me 12 hours.
Your case remains in court.
Yes.
Because...
And it's been held in stasis until this decision. And they were going to base their decision in part on this decision, on what happened with the Raich case. But in my case, there were so many irregularities and technical deficiencies. For instance, the judge himself said that the prosecutor had lied to the grand jury, but he said that was of no significance.
And, lied about what?
Well, he said to the grand jury that they were, that when he got the indictment, that they were going after these big drug dealers, and they weren't going after the medical marijuana clubs. And that was an out-and-out lie.
Explain what this whole movement is about, what these clubs are, why you are so committed to it.
Well, medical marijuana can help literally millions of people in the United States. And I don't want to go into the whole medical thing of it, but basically we have receptor sites in various parts of our body for a natural cannabinoid. It's called anandamide. And because of that, it's a very effective drug for many situations, from nausea, headaches, different kinds of pains, aches, stress release, and it goes on. And there are a lot of scientific studies on this, but done both in this country on animals and outside the country on humans. It's the safest medicine that you can have. There's never been a recorded case of a person dying from the use of marijuana. Just none. So that's what this is about.
Angel Rachel's story?
She has inoperable brain cancer, and the cancer has been held in check by constant use of marijuana. It isn't growing. She's not the only one. There's a fellow by the name of Steve Cubby who was brought to trial in California on state charges who also has inoperable brain cancer. And so Angel, along with Diane Monson, sued the federal government so that she could obtain to protect her sources of marijuana who were giving it to her for free. And there was no commerce. So she said, well, since the nexus of the federal laws to the states is commerce, and since there was no commerce, that she should be free from the federal laws. And in a contradiction, the Supreme Court actually ruled that even though there wasn't commerce, this affects commerce.
Talk about the Supreme Court justices who dissented, three of them, Chief Justice William Rehnquist, Justice Clarence Thomas, and Justice Sandra Day O'Connor. Yeah.
Well, you know, they're part of that ultra-right Republican group that believes in states' rights above everything, and that's why they voted for this. This was a states' rights issue versus the marijuana exception to the Constitution. And the marijuana exception to the Constitution says that even though it might be unconstitutional, because it's such a dangerous drug, even though it hasn't killed anybody ever, we can abrogate other constitutional provisions to keep marijuana from people. There have been so many cases regarding marijuana, and each time they've ruled against it, and they use spurious grounds to rule against it. And in fact, this case, actually, I think it's made great progress because it's the first time that it wasn't a unanimous decision against marijuana. We've won three. Now we just need another two.
So where do you see this whole movement going right now? Do you see this as a tremendous setback?
No, I see it as an advance. As I said, this is the first time Supreme Court justices have ever ruled in favor of marijuana. We've got three of them. We just need another two. And, Plessy versus, I don't think we'll have the same time frame, but this is sort of like a little past Plessy versus Ferguson in the civil rights movement, and where the originally, the Supreme Court caused a setback in integration and fair treatment of races. But on the other hand, this is going to cause every time the federal government has tried to do something with marijuana, there's been blowback. In 1937, marijuana was made illegal. There were 50,000 marijuana users. Now there are 50 million. That's pretty, look at that blowback.
How does the U.S. compare to the rest of the world?
In terms of, let's talk about, the democracies and European countries that we compare ourselves with. It's just like similar to the death penalty, except, where the United States is in the dark ages and the European governments are much more enlightened. Except for one thing, the majority of voting Americans believe that medical marijuana should be legal. And every time they've had a chance to vote for it, they voted in favor of it in all of these initiatives in 10 different states. And also, the majority of people in the United States, while they don't think that marijuana as a whole should be legal, they don't think that marijuana users should go to jail. And that's significant. And take this, for instance. If a kid uses marijuana and gets convicted of a marijuana misdemeanor, they're ineligible for any federal government help with their education. It's something that doesn't happen to rapists, burglars, any other kind of criminal class, just drug users, marijuana specifically.
They can never get a federal grant again for their
life.
Education.
For their life, yes.
Ed Rosenthal, I want to thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Ed Rosenthal is with Green Aid, a longtime marijuana rights activist. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, as we turn to this Democracy Now! Exclusive. Last month, 80 U.S. soldiers were killed in Iraq, making it the deadliest month for the U.S. military since January. The number of U.S. soldiers killed since the launch of the invasion has topped 1,600. As the U.S. occupation of Iraq continues, an increasing number of U.S. soldiers are saying no to war. Military recruitment goals have been down for months. The Army, in particular, is facing its biggest challenge to date in signing new recruits. A growing number of U.S. soldiers are crossing the border into Canada to seek asylum. Some say this is the first echo of the more than 100,000 war resistors who went north more than 30 years ago to escape the Vietnam War. Today, we speak with U.S. war resister Ryan Johnson. He recently came to Democracy Now! Studios with his wife, Jennifer, just before heading north to the Canadian border. I began by asking him about his reasons for his decision to leave.
Well, I mean, there's several reasons. I was in the Army, and, you know, just seeing the things that have been going on, and it was a hard decision for me to go. I just know that after everything that is over with, if I had stayed, it would have been more difficult for me to get a job in the area that I live in. And, you know, I just wanted to start over. Plus, you know, it's just like a real big political decision. It puts the issue of the war being illegal more international instead of just being here at home. And there just isn't enough media about what's going on with the soldiers.
When did you decide to enlist?
I enlisted November of 2003. I went to basic of March 2004, though. So there was like 6 months from the time I enlisted to the time that I actually went.
And why did you enlist?
Well, the town I'm from, well, not just the town, the area, the Central Valley that I'm from, it's mostly agriculture. And that's about all we have is like agriculture, fast food jobs. It's difficult to get a job there that pays over minimum wage.
Where do you live?
I live in Visalia, California.
Right near Fresno?
Yes.
And so how did the military become an option?
Well, after two or three years of just, like, going from one job to another, because I'd had, like, over 8 jobs in 2 years, and none of them had, really been able to sustain any sort of normal life for me. So we happened upon the Army website, and, they promised that it'll be a steady job, and you'll have a place to live, and you'll have food, which all of those are things that I hadn't had yet, so it sounded good at the time.
And did you meet with anyone, a recruiter, to make your decision?
I was actually going to do Army National Guard so that I could, just have pay here, and I went to speak to the recruiters, and I ended up talking to a regular Army recruiter, and...
And what'd they tell you?
Well, they promised everything. They said that, you know, I could get a big bonus for joining, and they have non-combat jobs, so you know, there's a less likely chance of going to Iraq or anything like that. And
did they say you'd go to Iraq?
Well, actually, my father is deceased, and I told them that, and they said, oh well. You know, since your father's deceased, you won't have to go. Because there is a clause that says that if you have a family member that is deceased, you won't have to go. But that's only if it's after you joined the military they died, and they had to have died in combat. They didn't tell me that. So I was under the impression that I wouldn't go.
And what did you think you'd be doing?
Well, the job that I was signed up for was warehouse workers. So... being a warehouse worker, I figured I wouldn't really be seeing any combat in Iraq anyway. That's how they made it sound.
Did you get a big bonus for signing?
Well, at the time, I thought it was good. I got, like, was it $40,000 for college?
$40,000?
Yeah, because, one of the things that I'd wanted to do was go to college. That's one of the reasons I joined. And $40,000 for college sounded really good at the time. After I got in, there was people that had the same job as me that went, like, a couple days after I went to sign up that had, like, $35,000 for college, plus they had choice of duty station and like $2,000 bonus, like, or seven. There's one guy that had $7,000 bonus on top of all the other things.
And so, did you go to college? Did you use? Were you given cash to do that, or they said they would pay directly to the college if you went?
You go through this program. You have to sign up and everything, and your commander has to okay for you to go to college. But no one was being okayed to go to college because we were just so busy with the deployment by the time that I got out of basic and everything. And all the soldiers that I had talked to, none of them had gone to college while they were in. I mean, there's like a very small percentage of people that actually take advantage of that.
November 2003, that means the invasion, the occupation was already on when you signed up.
Yes.
And what was your impression of it?
Well, the things that you see on TV and the things that you hear about, it sounds like we're doing like a lot of good things over there. We're rebuilding and, you know, we're bringing democracy to the country because that's what you hear on TV. That's what you hear people talk about. That's all you hear about it. So that was my impression of what was going on.
When did it start to change?
Well, I went through AIT and I'd heard some of the stories that the instructors had told us of what was going on over there, and our drill sergeants had impressions of people that had been taken captive and stuff like that. But then when I got into regular army, I started talking to soldiers that had already gone over there and come back, infantrymen and tank drivers and stuff like that, and the stories that they were giving me were just they were horrifying. One of my sergeants that had gone over there, he was an infantryman, and he was telling me that he doesn't remember actually killing anybody. He's not sure that he has, but watching his friends that are next to him being shot in the face, and you know, just some of the stuff that he had seen while he was there. He had post-traumatic stress disorder, and he's over there right now for a second time. Hmm.
As you started to ask questions, what did you do?
Well, first I wanted to, you know, just find out what I was looking at when I got over there, what it was going to be like. So I would just, people that I met, I'd be like, so I see you have a combat patch. Were you in Iraq? And they were like, yeah. And I'd ask them about, I would just ask them, like, how it was. And some of the people made it sound like it was, they had no problem with being over there. You know, they didn't have any post-traumatic stress disorder and stuff like that, and they were ready to go back. You know, they wanted to. And I wasn't, it kind of, that's the part that kind of started scaring me, that, you know, there was people going over there and they're killing people and they're coming back without any problems. But other people that I was talking to that had, you know, actually come back and been really hurt by it, seen a lot of really bad things and done a lot of really bad things, that that's what began to get me thinking that it wasn't the best thing to do.
We're talking to Ryan Johnson. He came into the Democracy Now! Studios with his wife, Jennifer, a little while ago before they headed for the Canadian border. We're going to speak to them in Toronto in just a minute. They have made it across the border. But first, we'll continue with the interview when I ask Jennifer about her husband's decision. Stay with us.
Thank you.
Song of the Underground Railroad by John Coltrane. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. We're broadcasting on over 330 radio and TV stations around the country, on Pacifica stations and affiliates, low-power FM stations, NPR stations, public access TV stations, PBS stations, and on both satellite networks, on Dish Network, Channel 9415, Free Speech TV, 9410, Link TV, as well on DirecTV, Channel 375. The video and audio stream at democracynow.org or closed caption for people who are deaf and hard of hearing, and our headlines are in Spanish at our website, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman as we return now to the conversation with Ryan and Jennifer Johnson, who came into our studio just before they crossed the Canadian border. Ryan, a war resister. I asked Jennifer about being with Ryan every step of the way and joining in this decision. I asked for her thoughts.
It's been really hard seeing a lot of the stuff that's happened. And we were just at Pablo's court-martial. We went down to San Diego, and just seeing what they were going through, it's been a big decision.
Do you think Ryan's right in doing what he's doing?
Yes.
Have you supported him all along the way?
Yes.
Did you think he should have signed up for the military?
I was behind it. I was the one that wanted him to go down and check it out. And I thought it was good at the time. They promised us a lot of stuff. But after hearing things, I don't agree with what's going on.
You'd been married for a few years?
Yes.
You guys are a very young couple. When did you get married?
2001.
You were 18?
I was 18. And Jennifer was 24. Or 21.
I'm 24 now.
Yeah.
So about 21.
Yeah.
You got married right out of high school. Did you graduate, Ryan, from high school?
I did not graduate from high school. I dropped out a year and a half before that, before we got married.
Was that an issue in going into the military? Did you need to have graduated?
Yeah, it was, because I went back and got my GED, but even still, it's really difficult to get a job without a couple of years in college in my area. But that still put me behind the curve, not having a high school diploma.
Well, it's been quite a while since you enlisted. November 2003. It's been about a year and a half. When did you decide you're not going to go to Iraq?
We'd been thinking about it for like quite a while. After I got to my duty station, I'd been talking to soldiers and stuff, but the decision wasn't completely made until it was the Wednesday before I was supposed to deploy.
Which was when?
What was that? It was January 12th or 13th of 2005. And yeah, it was January 12th, 13th, and we were supposed to deploy January 15th.
You were going to go to Iraq?
Yes.
So what'd you do?
Well, we just collected like all the information we could possibly get on becoming AWOL. Just off the internet and through talking to people. And I was scheduled to be at my unit at 8 a.m. So we could deploy at 9. And we left at 3 a.m. January 15th, so just like 4 or 5 hours before I was supposed to deploy.
Where was the base? Where were you going? Supposed to be going?
Well, we were going to go to Kuwait, and we were going to spend less than a month in Kuwait, and then we were going to drive the 350 miles down Airport Drive to Al Mamadiyah.
Did you talk to other people who were going to Iraq, other soldiers? Did you say you weren't going to go?
No, because I'd been considered AWOL once before. I didn't actually go AWOL. I was stuck in a snowstorm, and when I got back, I was treated very, pretty badly. I mean, I was they had me stand in the corner of the room the entire day, which was like 8 hours, and if I said I was tired, they'd have me do push-ups and sit-ups and jumping jacks and whatnot, which is pretty standard. At one point I had to go outside for formation, and one of my sergeants instructed me to talk to a different sergeant and tell him what had happened. And he was a sergeant first class. And he was just like, okay, I understand you were stuck in a snowstorm. Whatever. Then my other sergeant came outside, and he's like, why aren't you doing push-ups? Why aren't you still down on the ground? And I was like, well, he didn't tell me. He was all right with the fact that I was gone. He said, no, you get down and do push-ups. And I was doing push-ups, and he came back, and he said, did you know that you're considered a deserter because you're considered AWOL? I said, yeah, I guess I could be considered a deserter. And he said, I could shoot you right now because of that. Legally, I could shoot you. He said, do you want me to shoot you? I said, you have to do what you have to do, Sergeant. He said, well, I'm going to go talk to the first sergeant about it. And he left me outside doing push-ups. But, you know, I didn't talk to anybody about it. I left because of that fact, and I just knew that people wouldn't want to hear it, you know?
So, Ryan, where'd you go?
I went back to Visalia. Mm-hmm.
And now it's been, 5 months?
A little over 5 months.
How did you end up going to Pablo Paredes's court-martial in San Diego?
Well, one of the groups that I was talking to was the GI Rights Hotline, and they were organizing things for Pablo Paredes' case, protests and whatnot, and I had heard about it through them. And I decided that it would be a good thing for me to go to, just to, you know, see what I might be going through at that time, because I hadn't yet made the decision to go to Canada. And I went, and I was there for like 5 or 6 days with Pablo and Camilo and Aiden.
Camilo Mejia,
and
Florida Army National Guardsman, who was court-martialed and served almost a year in jail.
Yes, he was sentenced a year and ended up doing 9 months.
Aiden Delgado,
yeah.
Also went to Iraq.
Yes, who went to Iraq and became a conscientious objector while he was there.
And what kind of influence did that have on you?
You know, it was really inspiring to be around those people because, you know, Camilo had already been to Iraq and he came back. And then he, you know, it took that for him to stand up and say that this isn't right, you know, actually seeing it and being there. And Camilo, he did the same thing. He didn't come back and go through the same things, but he had to see what was going on there to realize that it was not really a good thing to be there and to be going through that. And he stood up to his commanding officer and his first sergeant and said, I'm not going to take part in this. I'll stay here, but I will not take part in the fighting.
And so you were at the court-martial. Were you at the court?
No, there was only very few people that were allowed to go inside the court, so I stayed outside with all the protesters and everything, and they would the people that could go into the court-martial, they would call back with information to what was going on, letting us know what the judge was saying and what had been happening.
Were you concerned about being caught?
No, that's one of the least of my concerns, really. I was concerned that if I got caught, they would still try and force me to go to Iraq. That was my only concern. But jail time is not a big deal to me.
So why have you decided to go to Canada?
Well, if I eventually turned myself in, because you can't run forever, eventually you have to be able to sustain life and get a job and everything, I would do my time or whatever, and I'd get out, but then I'd have to go back to Visalia. That's because that's the only place that I would have to live. And then not only would I be a high school dropout, but I'd also have, you know, jail time on my record. So there's going to be no way of me getting any sort of decent job there. And I'd be stuck in the same place I was before. So there was that. And then going to Canada is like this, it's a really big political decision you have to make. You have to decide that you want to really get the word out there about what's going on with the soldiers. And this makes like an international type thing. You go there and it gets the word out there a little bit more than just staying at home and going to jail and everything.
And you're willing to do that?
Yeah, I would love to
be able to just show people, you know, that it's not worth it and that this war is illegal.
Ryan Johnson, a war resister, spoke to us with his wife, Jennifer, in our studios at Democracy Now! Here in New York, then headed north, crossed the border into Canada, and is now in Toronto, where he joins us on the telephone. Ryan Johnson with us at the Catholic Worker House. Also, Rob Shearer, who is with Toronto Catholic Worker, part of a network that's helping Ryan and soldiers like him to seek asylum in Canada. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! Well, Ryan, how was your trip?
It was great. I made it to Toronto, obviously. It's nice here.
How did you get there?
We took my car. We drove from California. We went across the, just drove across the border.
Did you have any problems crossing the border?
Not at all. We expected them to ask for ID and birth certificate, and they just asked us a few questions. Asked, you know, we said we were going shopping. They're like, come on in. Let's right through.
How did you end up at the Toronto Catholic Worker?
I was staying at someone else's house, and Jeremy Hinsman advised me to contact them, because they might have a place for me to stay a little bit longer term than just couch surfing in different people's houses.
And Jeremy Hinsman is another U.S. soldier like you who went to Canada. He actually applied for political refugee status and was recently, that request was rejected, and he has appealed the decision.
Yes.
Rob Shearer, can you talk about what you're doing at the Toronto Catholic Worker, what this idea of modern-day underground is?
Sure, yeah. I think it's first of all important to point out that from 1965 to 73, there were 50,000 draft-age Americans who made their way to Canada refusing to participate in what they considered an immoral war. And so Canada has always... in some ways, tried to be a place of asylum for people who want to resist the empire, so to speak. Sorry. So the Catholic Worker is part of a network of organizations and political organizations, faith-based organizations, right across the spectrum. Saying that we are committed to making sure that if people want to make decisions based on their conscience to not fight in what is an illegal and immoral war, then we will do our best to support them.
What is the Canadian government's response to what you're doing?
I think in some way the Canadian government is apathetic about it. I mean, we have to remember the majority of Canadians don't support the war, and the Canadian government, in fact, doesn't support this war. I think basically what the very polite Canadian response is going to be to kind of see it through the courts. I think we're seeing that with Jeremy Hinsman, who was a soldier in the 82nd Airborne Division who came over here in January 2004. He's, as you mentioned, he was just rejected on his first refugee hearing, but there's going to be a whole process of appeals, and many people in the war resistance movement here, and I believe Jeremy himself, are quite confident that when it gets up to the higher levels of the court, there's greater chances of success, and hopefully buying into that Canadian history of being a place of asylum for people who are trying to escape and make judgments based on their conscience and often out of their faith, as is in Jeremy's case.
In October, we went to Canada to interview Jeremy Hinsman and Brandon Huey. Since they couldn't be in this country, we thought we would go to them and interviewed them at the studios of CBC, Canadian Broadcasting Corporation, with their lawyer, who is a Vietnam War resister from the United States, who's now doing legal work in Canada.
That's right. Brandon
Huey also joined us. He made his case last week, appearing at a hearing in a bid to gain permanent asylum as a refugee. Can you talk about his case?
To be honest, I'm not that familiar with Brandon's case. I wouldn't want to speak too much to it. I can speak on a broader level in so much as I know that there's a good number of people who of resistors from the U.S. military who've shown up. I believe the last time I spoke to Jeremy, which you know was a few weeks ago, there was something like 8 or 9 families who were seeking refugee status or who had left, and that's only taking into account, of course, the military quotient there. We certainly get calls all the time from civilians in the United States saying that living in the midst of the hysteria and the empire that's there is getting more and more unlivable. And I know there's lots of debates about whether it's wise to abandon that and jump ship and come to Canada or not, but we certainly do hear a lot of requests from people.
In looking at the Toronto Sun, they said that the person who heard Huey's case from the Immigration Refugee Board, Brian Goodman, said that Huey's bid for refugee status rests on whether human rights abuses in Iraq by coalition forces are systematic or not.
Right.
Let me end with Ryan Johnson. What significance do the people who've come before you, who've gone to Canada, like Jeremy Hinsman, like Brandon Huey, and the people who've resisted in the United States, like Camilo Mejia, like Pablo Paredes, Aiden Delgado, what impact do they have on you?
Well, because of them, I found out about the movement. We found Jeremy Hinsman's site before I went AWOL. And one of our first thoughts was to go to Canada, and we found the GI Rights Hotline. And we were looking at that, and we found stuff on Camilo Mejia, Aiden Delgado, and, you know, it kind of inspired me that people were doing this. It let me know that there were other people like me that weren't wanting to go to the war, and that there's people just trying to get it out there to, you know, soldiers and civilians alike, letting them know that they're not the only ones that don't believe in it.
Well, Ryan Johnson, I want to thank you very much for being with us again, speaking to us from Canada. He successfully crossed the border with his wife, Jennifer, a U.S. soldier resisting war. Also, Rob Shearer of the Toronto Catholic Worker. Photojournalists Andrew Stern and Rick Rowley of Big Noise Films are both working on documentary projects about Ryan and the new Underground Railroad that's helping war resistors leave the military. You can reach them at their websites, andrewstern.net and bignoisefilms.com. That does it for today's program. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Sharif Abdelkadous, John Hamilton, Anna Nagara, Elizabeth Press, Yoruba Richin, Jeremy Scahill, Nell Geiser, and Maddie Harper. Mike DeFilippo is our engineer. Our website is democracynow.org. You can sign up for our daily headlines and media alerts at our website. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.